It would be really helpful if you could turn to the passage that was read to us. I think it's page 1075 in these red church Bibles. John's Gospel, chapter 9, page 1075. While you're looking that up, let me just tell you about an incident that happened to me. It was April the 2nd, 2011. I was driving the car locally and was listening to the World Cup cricket final between Sri Lanka and India. It was a real grudge match, a fiercely fought one. And I just pulled into our local garage after I'd heard that India had won this cricket World Cup final. And the guys in the garage were really, really friendly guys, and I knew they'd been watching the cricket. I could see them watching on their TVs. And as I was paying for my fuel, I said, "Guys, what a great result. Isn't it wonderful?" Because I could see they were Indians. "Isn't it wonderful that India won the cricket?" And these guys, who are normally very friendly to me, absolutely blanked me. They just looked at each other, looked away from me, took my money, and said not a word. I was utterly mystified. I thought they'd be celebrating a little more than that. So I got home and relayed this to my wife, Ruth. I said, "Ruth, how do you account for that? I just congratulated them on winning the World Cup." She said, "Well, maybe, Richard, it has something to do with the fact that the garage is owned and run by Sri Lankans." I said, "What?" She said, "Yeah, Sri Lankan Indians." I said, "How do you know that?" She said, "Well, ever since the cricket started, they've had this massive Sri Lankan flag outside the garage." So there's just, you know, a little clue in that. Now, John, as he writes this gospel, says that everything he's written provides clues so we don't miss the big flag of who Jesus is. All these things are written so that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ, and that by believing in him, we might have life in his names. He's convinced, John is, as he writes this, that if we just follow the clues, go where the evidence goes, we're going to end up seeing who Jesus is and discovering the life he offers. So here's our passage, John chapter 9. I've got such a massive Bible, I can't quite fit it in here. That's quite a boast, isn't it, really? Let me tuck it to the side. Okay. The passage divides up really nicely. So verses 1 to 7, we're going to look at the miracle. Verses 8 to 38, which is the main bulk of what we're looking at, the man. And then right at the end, and if you're really nervous when we haven't got to the third point and you think I should be finishing, this is quite a short section, the meaning, the miracle, the man, and the meaning. Well, first of all, the miracle. Jesus heals a blind man. Now, the healing of the blind is the commonest miracle in the New Testament. But this was an exceptional healing in as much as this man, verse 1, was blind from birth. In Jesus' day, many people had temporary blindness or recent blindness from bad sanitation, dusty conditions. But not so this guy. He was an absolutely hopeless case. He never had the capacity to see. And in verse 2, the disciples asked Jesus a question. "Teacher, why was this man born blind? Was it a result of his own sin or those of his parents?" Now, these disciples make Simon Cowell sound tactful, don't they? Or even Richard Cunningham congratulating the Sri Lankans on their loss in the cricket. But it's really true to life. It deliberately doesn't put the disciples in a favorable light. That's not what the Gospels are about. They're reportage. John is concerned to get this right. Now, it may seem an odd question to us, but religious Jews believe that God rewards the righteous and punishes the wicked. Hence the question, who sinned, this man or his parents? Now, that may sound curious, but it's not so far from us, is it? When somebody's suffering, often people say, "Why me? What have I done?" Well, look at Jesus' answer in verse 3. "This ought to put such superstition to bed once and for all. It was not because of his sins or his parents' sins." Jesus makes a causal link absolutely ruled out. I have a niece who has inoperable brain and spinal tumors. She has cancer pretty much all over that region. Now, is it her sin or the sin of her parents? "Wrong question," says Jesus. A boy attacked an old lady and robbed her. Now, that old lady may well have said at the time, "Why me? Was it because of bad things I've done?" No. But the Bible does tell us that there's a genetic solidarity that links all of us to the rest of our fellow human beings, for good or for ill. Now, we know that's true with environmental issues like global warming. I mean, take the boy, for example. He had no father, and he'd been physically abused by a number of his mother's boyfriends over the years. And it may well be, like many East End families, that ever since the Great War, when so many men were killed, there was no male figure in his household. Now, I'm not excusing his behavior. All I'm saying is that the events leading up to that seeming random mugging of an old woman began at least with the pride and the aggression of politicians who precipitated a great war. You see, everything is linked together. Similarly with brain tumors and blindness. The first people who rebelled against God and introduced a fracture into this world, well, they were the ones who brought sickness, suffering. And consequently, this blind man in our passage, my niece, they are in genetic solidarity with those first humans. And so are we. We share in the consequences of their actions as they tumbled down time and space, missing others and hitting some. And of course, that's why it does seem so random and so unfair. I think that's an important superstition to clear up, not least because Jesus is more interested in the purpose than the cause. Look at verse 3. This man was born blind so that the power of God could be seen in him. Now, Jesus is pretty confident, isn't he? This is remarkable. He knows that as the light of the world, which he claims in verse 5, he knows that as the light of the world, he can cause this man to see physically. But even more importantly, Jesus can cause him to see spiritually, to be able to recognize who is standing in front of him. Jesus, as the light of the world, is going to dispel darkness from this man's eyes, but also from his heart. But what's shocking, as we heard that reading, is as the light shines, the darkness tries to overcome it. Within hours of this needy man being healed, the religious leaders are plotting how they can murder Jesus. It's a very edgy situation. The tension crackles throughout chapter 9. But you know what? Jesus isn't remotely afraid of these religious leaders. In fact, he deliberately challenges them by spitting in verse 6. Now, he's not being vulgar. When I first went out with my wife, Ruth, she noticed I didn't always use a hanky when I blew my nose, and she was utterly outraged. By the way, I've sorted that one out. After 28 years of marriage, my act has cleaned up considerably. But it's not that Jesus is being vulgar. He's issuing a challenge. You see, application of spittle to the eyes is forbidden in rabbinic law. And even worse, he does this on the Sabbath day. He makes his paste, rubs it into his eyes, and effects a healing. Jesus is deliberately drawing their gaze because he knows as he draws the dark attention of these people to himself, it's going to be partly through their reaction that this blind man will actually see spiritually. So off he goes. Verse 7, he goes to the pool in Siloam with this paste all over his face and washes it off, and he comes home seeing. Well, so much for the miracle. Now the man. And John spends much more time on the man. Now, there are four little conversations here that we're meant to eavesdrop on and then move on to the next one. And we notice this man considering, who is this guy? He's trying to pick up clues and move with the evidence. But be ready for the twist at the end. Okay, 8 to 12, the first conversation. It's the man who's just been healed and the neighbors and townsfolk, those who know him best. Now, did you notice the incredulity in verses 8 and 9? They're saying, isn't this a guy who was born blind? No, it can't be. It certainly looks like him, but it's not him. And he's saying, of course it's me. I should know. They're still talking about him as if he's not quite all there. Notice how honest and straightforward this guy is. He knows what he knows. He knows he was blind. He knows that he is the right person. But he doesn't know, verses 11 and 12, who healed him. Now, John wants us to realize simply that this miracle was attested by those who were there, who were conversant with what happened, who knew the man. Second conversation, 13 to 17. So it's the man born blind who finds himself swiftly brought before the religious leaders, the Pharisees. And he retells his story. I mean, it's a pretty remarkable story, and they need to hear it. Now, what's the reaction? Verse 16. They are utterly unimpressed. This man is not from God, for he's working on the Sabbath. Jesus, having performed this remarkable miracle that nobody had ever heard of before, should have been embraced by the religious leaders, but instead, he's reviled. He's offended their fixed religious sensibilities. Anybody who goes against our traditions cannot be from God. Now, lest we think too harshly of the Pharisees, you know, we can easily be like that, can't we? We can develop prior assumptions about reality, particularly about God and Jesus, that have become like a permanent screensaver. And we barely know they're there until one of them's offended. Maybe we come across Jesus saying, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. And we think, hang on, the arrogance. There's a billion Muslims in this world. How can you say that? Well, that's a challenge for us, isn't it? What do we do? Do we make our culturally conditioned sensibilities the absolute bedrock of reality? Or do we yield when we hear Jesus take? If Jesus is who he claims to be, God in human form, shouldn't those sensibilities be shaped and changed by what he says? Well, there is a clash of authorities, and it doesn't look like they're going to back down at all. Well, the Pharisees' presuppositions are challenged, the evidence is in front of them, and some of their number do seem to have more of an open mind. Some of their numbers say, if Jesus was an ordinary sinner, how could he do such a miracle? It's a great question, verse 16. One that should cause them to take the next step to the light. But instead, 17, they throw the question back to the man born blind. They're cornered, so they take the coward's way out. Who do you say he is? Nice footwork. Who do you say he is? Oh, me? Well, he must at least be a prophet. Do you notice the progress? In verse 11, the blind man referred to Jesus as the man who healed me. But having heard the dispute in verse 17, he's gradually piecing the clues together and thinks, you know what? Having heard 5 minutes of blind prejudice, I'm utterly convinced he's got to be from God. He must at least be a prophet. His eyes are gradually opening. He's gradually seeing the clues. It's not just a man. He is from God. He must be a prophet. And that leads us to the third conversation, verses 18 through to 23. The Pharisees don't like his answers, so they ask for his parents. Hopefully they'll tell something that is a little bit more acceptable. Now here it gets a little farcical, becomes more like an old Monty Python sketch. Let me read to you from verse 18. They still did not believe that he'd been blind and had received his sight until they sent for the man's parents. Is this your son? They asked. Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it now that he can see? We know he's our son, the parents answered, and we know he was born blind, but how he can now see or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him, he's of age. He will speak for himself, and so it goes on. I think the parents had picked up just how brooding and deep this darkness was becoming. And when the Pharisees said, jump, you just said, how high? They didn't want to become social outcasts and lose all their privileges. So in the end, they said, ask our son. But what an astonishing thing to ask of parents with a son born blind. You say he was born blind, but are you sure? I mean, as a parent, it's not the sort of thing you make a mistake about, is it? I mean, let's be honest. We've all sent our kids to school with, you know, maybe the wrong uniform. I sent my kids to school with non-matching shoes before. But even I would recognize if I had a son who was born blind. Now, I'm sure if they weren't so afraid, they would have loved to have sent them up and said, oh, good question, are we sure? We knew he was a little clumsy at school, struggled a bit, especially games, bit of a problem with games, but we thought it's probably a bit down, you know, probably down to him having football boots that were too tight. So, well, of course we know he was born blind, but they didn't. Now, it's good that we're laughing. We're meant to be laughing. The frightening thing is the Pharisees aren't. They are in deadly serious earnest about this. The Pharisees refuse to acknowledge the absurdity of their conclusions, and instead, they want to put things back on other people. Now, I suspect that some of us here might need to see just how funny some of our objections are to Christian faith. I don't mean those really serious objections that trouble us that I was talking about earlier. Of course, we have those. And this Wednesday is a great opportunity. If you have any question, only one question you wish to ask God and know it would be answered, well, that's the topic of this Wednesday at 7 o'clock down in the Waldegrave Hall. Come to that, because it's so important for those questions to be considered. But you know what I mean, don't you? Sometimes we hide behind these presuppositions. And if we don't learn to laugh at our objections, we will become dark and we will actually become unable to really have a proper conversation. Something similar happens in our relationships. You know how it goes with a girlfriend or boyfriend? I don't know. With my wife, I've sort of, you know, feel that, you know, a right has been infringed, I've been misunderstood, she hasn't read my mind or something like that. And there's just a horrid atmosphere until the point at which there's laughter. By the way, fellas, not you laughing at your wife or your girlfriend. So if you're taking notes, do not write that down. I should now laugh at my wife. No. It's when, in that situation, I can learn to laugh at how absurd my behavior is. But the Pharisees get beyond that point. They've actually set up this farcical conversation, asking a blind man's parents, are you sure this is your son you say was born blind? Well, maybe you've still got opinions you formed when you were eight, that the Bible was made up, that Jesus probably didn't exist, that Christianity's just a crutch, that Jesus was a good moral teacher. That's a long time ago when you were eight. I look back when I was eight, and you know what? I hated girls. I thought they were utterly stupid. They didn't seem to like football. At the beginning of the day at school, they would take a football if it came their way and throw it over the fence. Never understood what that was about. They didn't know how to blow their noses either. Oh, we've already covered that one, haven't we? But I've changed my mind. I've changed my mind, not about the nose blowing, but about girls. I think girls are fantastic. And so fantastic, I married one. I've been married to one for 28 years. Now again, forgive me for mucking about, but I think the kind of farce in this passage is encouraging us to actually look at our hearts and see what's there and learn to actually have a quiet laugh about us. Unless we do that, we will get darker and move further and further away from the evidence. Don't be blinded by the light, Jesus says. Move further towards it. And that's exactly what happens in the fourth and final conversation, 24 to 34. Rather than back down and laugh at this farce, they try to force the man to lie. It's utterly incredible. They have an opportunity now to say, okay, we got it wrong. We've interviewed your parents. We've interviewed the guys on the street. We know you are their son. We know you were born blind. We can see that you're able to see now. No, they don't. And the man born blind is utterly astonished, and he pokes fun at them, since they're unwilling to do it to themselves. And effectively, he says from verse 30, well, thank you, most reverent teachers. I was blind from birth. I'd been made to see. This is the most wonderful day of my life. And all you can tell me about this man is he's a sinner. We don't even know where he comes from. Who's your father? Who's your father? Who's your father, referee? That's what it's about. I mean, how low can you get? But they can't stand it. They're beyond laughing at their skepticism. They've missed the moment to laugh at themselves. And so they throw this vulnerable man out, verse 34. He becomes persona non grata, an outcast, denied all social and civic privileges. Well, the blind man has seen the emptiness and bitterness of those who oppose Jesus, and he's ready for Jesus to come to him. And that's what happens in verse 35. He's been made to see for the first time in his life, but his loyalty and his gratitude to Jesus cost him his place in society. And then as Jesus stands before him, suddenly the small hairs on the back of his neck are up. The penny drops. He now realizes that Jesus isn't merely a man or even a prophet. He knows that Jesus is God in human form. That's who's standing in front of him. And he falls at his feet and worships him. The one in whom he lives, moves, and has his being is now in front of him. And he knows the delicious forgiveness, the acceptance of being right with God. Well, lastly, the meaning. Well, simply, it's all about seeing. Notice again the stages of restoration of the man's spiritual sight. 11, he saw Jesus as a man. Verse 17, as a prophet. And then by verse 38, as the Christ, as Lord. Well, it's good to ask us where we're at. Do we see Jesus as a good man? If so, John would suggest our blindness is pretty acute. Or maybe we see him as a prophet, but again, we're not allowed to stay there because prophets don't forgive sin or receive worship as Jesus does here. Are we at verse 38 yet, where we can see that Jesus is God walking on his planet, forgiving sin, receiving worship, and ultimately going to a cross, defeating death and rising again? Well, that's who he is. That's who's in front of us, courtesy of John's gospel. You might ask, well, okay, Richard, but how does this work for me? How can I have this spiritual sight? How can I be made right with God? Well, how did the man get to see in the first place? Well, quite simply, verse 7, he did as he was told. Striking, isn't it, that Jesus was allowed to put mud on his eyes, and the man actually sensed something about Jesus that was authoritative and did as he was told and went and washed. He could have been understandably offended, don't you think? He could have said, hey, stop picking on me. Why don't you take your quackery somewhere else? Why don't you impress your followers with somebody who's perhaps less of a hard case than me? Leave me alone. He does nothing of the sort. He goes and he washes and he comes back seeing. Now, it may be that when you hear Christians talking about the death of Jesus as being the key, that it's the cross where Jesus provides the means by which we can be made right with God, that we can be healed and see spiritually again, that we can put our head on the pillow and know that we're right with God, that all that we've done that we're ashamed of is forgiven at the cross. Why the cross? Why can't it be me being a good religious person, coming to church, doing lots of good works? Jesus said, do as you're told. It's the cross. In fact, he asked his Father if there was any other way that this could be accomplished other than the cross. And God the Father answered with a deafening silence. My niece, who has the incurable brain tumors, she was a very keen ballet dancer. She's just, you know, at that stage, coming into teenage years, long blonde hair, loved her ballet. And so she obviously took the diagnosis and, of course, the treatment very, very hard. And she wrote a reflection, which I'm just going to read a very short extract from, which has subsequently been published. So here it is. This is my niece, Rachel. She says this: the treatment to get rid of the tumors was to last a year, a whole year. I was likely to feel sick for a large chunk of that time, but that wasn't the worst. I would lose my hair, all of it. I shook it out, sadly pulling a lock and holding it against my thigh. Optimism drained away quite suddenly. I could put up with everything else, but surely I didn't have to lose my hair. There was no mistake. It was the future. It was the future I had to face, but I wasn't ready for it. For the first time in hospital, I cried and I cried into my pillow, into my mum's arms, to God, to anyone who would listen. My sadness felt overwhelming. It was a time of crisis. Who should I speak to? There was my mum, but I'm a teenager. You don't pour out your heart to your mother when you're a teenager. I wondered who to call. Lots of fantastic friends had said I could call on them at any time, but this was mid-morning. Most would be at school or work. Then I remembered my friend John. He'd be at home. He was retired. He was a friendly man with a round face and short white beard, a bit like Captain Birdseye. He used to be a sailor as well, and he came straight round. I told him everything as I cried and shook with fear. Hey, stop it, Rachel, he said. What are you afraid of? What if you do die? I knew I'd picked the right person. I breathed deeply as I brought myself under control. John wasn't in a hurry for my answer. I thought quietly to myself, I was afraid of pain. I'd had enough of that already, but I had no need to be afraid of dying, had I? I thought back to when I first understood that Jesus, God's Son, had died in my place. I thought it incredible that God could love us all so much when mostly we take no notice of him. I remembered going home and quietly praying to God in my room. I'd thanked him that Jesus had taken my punishment, and I'd asked him to make me his child. Since that day, I'd been certain that God was with me, whether things were going well or badly. I knew in that moment, if I died, God would give me life forever. I looked up at John. If I do die, John, I'll go straight to heaven. I said. Now, whilst it still may seem curious that we have to come to the cross, it is the only way. And if you're not yet a follower of Jesus, the key thing is to make sense of this evidence and go where it leads you. Don't be blinded by this light, but be led by it. So you find yourself in that position at the foot of the cross, so to speak, where you're worshiping Jesus as your Lord and God. So the meaning is really verse 39, Jesus says, I've come to judge the world, I've come to give sight to the blind, and to show those who think they see that they are blind. That's quite a shocking end, really, isn't it? Jesus' words are double-edged. They're like a sword. They have an intrinsic capacity to judge the human race and divide us straight down the middle. In one camp, maybe as we walk out of here tonight, maybe some of us, God forbid, will walk out blinder and harder than before. But then there is another group, and that can be all of you. If you will move with the evidence, pick up the clues, see who Jesus is, acknowledge your spiritual blindness, and then you will see who Jesus is, what he has done for you, and acknowledge that by virtue of who he is, what he's done on the cross, we can indeed be forgiven and go home rejoicing. At the very least, come along on Wednesday to that Christianity Explored course at 7 o'clock here. You see, Jesus is not only big enough to meet our need, he's also close enough. He is the source of meaning, life, sight, purpose. And by his Holy Spirit, he can be spoken to and he will respond. I'm going to invite Ruth to sing now. And just before she does, I'm going to read the words of a prayer that I'm going to pray at the end of the song. It's a prayer in a little booklet I wrote, which I'm going to make available at the end. And it simply goes like this. I'll just read the words, then Ruth will sing, and then right at the end, I'll pray it as a prayer. And if having reflected on these words during Ruth's song, as you consider whether you're willing to follow Jesus, if you decide that you are ready, that you are willing, that most of your substantial questions are answered by Jesus, then why not pray this as your own prayer? And Jesus will hear it. So the words I'm going to pray in a moment are this. Lord God, I admit that I've lived independently of you and have offended your love and provoked your anger with my attitudes and with my life. I realize that you are too holy and good to simply overlook my sin. Thank you that you love me so much you are willing to give your only son to die in my place. I now turn away from everything that is wrong in my life and ask you to forgive me by virtue of who Jesus is and what he achieved on the cross. Please send the Holy Spirit of Jesus to live in me, to renew me, and help me to be a follower of Jesus from this day on and for the rest of my life. Are we willing to make that step of following Jesus? Let's just bow our heads and I'll pray that prayer. And if having reflected on all you've heard tonight, you feel that you are ready to walk with Jesus and follow him by virtue of who he is and all he's done, then why not echo these words in your heart and God will hear your prayer and will respond. Lord God, I admit that I've lived independently of you and have offended your love and provoked your anger with my proud, selfish attitude to you and to all that you've made. I acknowledge that Jesus willingly laid down his life for me, bearing the punishment my sin deserves, and that he now offers me the forgiveness I don't deserve. I now turn away from everything that is wrong in my life and ask you to forgive me by virtue of who Jesus is and what he achieved on the cross. Please send the Spirit of Jesus to live in me, to renew me, and help me to be a follower of Jesus from this day on and for the rest of my life. Amen.